Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the program, and a fantastic day to you. You can call in right now, 1-888-914-9149. Studio line to talk to me for free on the Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149. And you can email the program too, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter. Grab onto my Twitter handle, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E, and the show account is at Cale Clark Show. Well, it is Tuesday. It is March the 15th. You know what that means? It is the Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March. And I don't know if you read the play Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare. I don't know whether you had to do that in school or you got to do that in school. Maybe that's a better way to put it. To my everlasting shame, I must confess I haven't read that one. Got to get on that. I did do a couple of Shakespeare plays in high school, but not that one. We were kind of limited to what we were given at that time. But we do know what it's about. We do know the historical events that Shakespeare sort of dramatized there. Of course, on March the 15th in the year 44 BC, some members of the Roman Senate stabbed Julius Caesar to death. More than 20 times they stabbed him during one of their Senate meetings in the Eternal City in Rome. Of course, Brutus, oh, not you, Brutus, two Brutus, Marcus Brutus, Gaius Cassius, they were in on it along with some others. And what they wanted to do was restore Rome to the glory it once had, in their view, trying to bring it back to being a republic. But that's not what happened. Instead, Rome fell into civil war. And J.D. Flynn, writing in The Pillar today, talked about how, in some ways, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Maybe you guys saw the tweet from Senator Lindsey Graham, which he tweeted out on March the 4th. And here's what he said. He said, "Is there a Brutus in Russia? Is there a more successful Colonel Stauffenberg in the Russian military? The only way this ends is for somebody in Russia to take this guy out. You would be doing your country and the world a great service." That's what Lindsey Graham, at Lindsey Graham SC, Senator Graham, tweeted out on March the 4th, basically calling for a coup, an assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin in Russia. And the latest news today is that the Russians were actually bombing a hospital full of patients, civilians. It's just horrendous. Now, obviously, as J.D. Flynn pointed out, that's not the kind of thing a senator says on the regular. But what actually happened in Rome after Caesar was murdered? Well, it actually had incredible repercussions for the church, for the world, for centuries to come. Now, this is obviously before the time of Jesus Christ, but even Jesus himself had to deal with this, and it affected a lot of things about his life and ministry. Now, after Caesar was killed, civil war broke out, Brutus died, and Rome was not ruled by the noblest Roman of them all, but rather those motivated by self-interest rather than virtue, as J.D. Flynn wrote. And eventually we saw Augustus rise, Augustus Caesar. Yeah, Octavius became known as Augustus, and he called himself Divi Filius, the son of God, the son of the divine one. Now, this is exactly what happened to make the introduction of Jesus Christ on the scene so dramatic. And I remember once when I was studying the Gospel of Mark, and I was taking a class with Dr. Craig Evans, and it just kind of blew my mind. It really made history come alive for me, because when you read Mark's Gospel, and up to that point, I wouldn't have said that Mark was my favorite of the four Gospels. I don't know what your favorite gospel is, but you know, I would have said maybe John at that point. But the more I study Mark, the more I grow to love it. And it's a different kind of gospel than the others in a certain sense. I believe, along with the majority of scholars out there, that Mark was the first gospel that was written. You say, well, why does Matthew come first in the New Testament then? Well, it's because Matthew is a very Jewish gospel. Presents Jesus as a new Moses, a new and greater Moses, and there's so many ties to the Old Covenant, to the Old Testament. I think it's a natural bridge between the Old Covenant and the New. But when you look at St. Mark, he's very sparse in his narrative of points. And the way it starts off, it sounds kind of ho-hum to us, but it really would have been sending shockwaves through the entire world at that time in the first century. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. This is known as the incipit, or sort of the theme verse, the beginning verse of the gospel. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Another way of saying that, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, with that whole sentence, that as we say, we've heard this before, yet we know he's the Christ, we know he's the Son of God, but believe me, he has got the full attention of everybody in the world, Jew and Gentile. Well, for Jewish readers, it's pretty obvious that Jesus Christ, Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ means Messiah, the anointed one. This is the expected Messiah that you were hoping for. But what about the Romans? What about the rest of the world? Well, it comes in that phrase, Son of God, the Son of God. And it's something that would have struck the Romans in particular. And when you read Mark, you sort of have to ask, you know, what is this really all about? I think it's a Greco-Roman biography. And I used to kind of maybe not think that. I remember when I was in a Protestant seminary, I got that question wrong on an exam. I argued that the gospel was something new, that Mark had created kind of a new genre of literature called a gospel. But now I tend to agree with those who would say, you know what, it really is a Greco-Roman biography. That's the form of the gospel. And so that's kind of biography that was written in the ancient world, but it's a little bit different when it comes to the gospels, because there's really nothing in any of the gospels with respect to Jesus' appearance. They don't tell us what he looked like. They don't tell us that much about his personality. You would see stuff like this in other biographies, although we can see Jesus' personality shining through in his teachings, and even his great sense of humor, which comes through a lot in his teaching. Doesn't talk about what he likes to eat for breakfast, his habits, anything like that, but talks about his public life. When you go to Mark, it really starts off with his public life. There's no infancy gospel in Mark. There's some chatter about his early life in chapter 6 when he's in his hometown of Nazareth and people are talking about him, his background. But really, it's all about his public ministry and especially about his fate in Jerusalem. And that's why really one of the most important characters in the entire gospel comes in chapter 15. In Mark chapter 15, verse 39, we see the Roman centurion who was there and watches Jesus die on the cross. This is a super, super important moment in the gospel. And what does he say? Well, as he sees Jesus die, he says, truly, this man is the Son of God. He basically comes to hail Jesus as Son of God. He was really supposed to say that about his boss in Rome, the Caesar. Hail Caesar. That's right. Before he was a salad, he was a Roman emperor. And so, hail Caesar. So the Roman soldier, from his lips, we get this incredible truth that truly this man, not my boss, was the Son of God. The one who seems so powerless right now. And that was the most ignominious death that you could ever suffer in the Roman Empire, to be crucified. They didn't even do that to Roman citizens. That's why St. Paul was beheaded, as opposed to crucified. Peter, he was a Galilean. He wasn't a Roman citizen. They didn't care about him. He was crucified upside down. But St. Paul was beheaded. It's kind of the more, I guess, humane way to execute someone. It's over quickly. But they don't crucify Roman citizens. That was only for the worst of the worst criminals in the empire. And that's why one major writer on Mark's gospel, Robert Gundry, he called his commentary on Mark an apology for the cross, because the early Christians, the early church, the early Catholic Church were in a bit of a bind because they had to try to convince their neighbors, they had to try to convince their friends, many of whom were Romans, that this man is the one you should be worshiping, this person who was crucified, who seems like the most powerless of all, crucified, naked. It's a shameful death. There was no little loincloth, you know, on Jesus on the cross. I mean, this is for art, this is for propriety, but what happened to him, and again, people think Mel Gibson went over the top in the Passion of the Christ movie with the scourging. I don't think he did. I think it's very historical from what I've studied about it. The early Christians had to convince people to believe in this guy, not the powerful Caesar in Rome. And that's a bit of an uphill battle. And that's why the credentials of Jesus are so important, and they're kind of laid out in the gospel. And so let's talk about what happened on this day in 44 BC. Julius Caesar, now after his death, later on, he was quote-unquote deified. You know what they found? Archaeologists have found these inscriptions from the ancient world, from the Roman Empire in the first few centuries. And they were kind of like, I guess you could say public theology. This was stuff that you were supposed to know. These were inscriptions on buildings, public places. And here's what they found about Julius Caesar. This was an inscription. Julius Caesar was called the manifest God from Mars and Aphrodite and the universal savior of human life. Wow. Really? Okay, so obviously the pantheon of Greek gods, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, Mars, the god of war. Okay, so he's their spawn, their offspring, as it were. So, post-mortem, he was deified. Here's another one from the Carthian people. It says, the Carthian people honor the god and emperor and savior. Listen to that. The savior of the inhabited world, Gaius Julius Caesar, son of Gaius Caesar. So, now Augustus, who eventually became Emperor Augustus Octavian, so basically what they did was they kind of went back in time and they said, okay, Caesar was a living god. And every emperor that came after him was known as a son of God, a divine son of God. So if you did a really good job as an emperor, you would be deified after your death, post-mortem deification. That's what happened to Augustus, who reigned from 30 BC until 14 AD. Here's one they found for Augustus. Emperor Caesar Augustus, son of God. Here's another one. Emperor Caesar, God from God. Does that sound familiar to you? Does that not sound to you like the Nicene Creed? God from God, light from light, true God, begotten, not made, consubstantial with the Father. So this is Jesus Christ. He is in reality what they pretended to be. And then there was Tiberius. Caesar Tiberius, and this guy was vile. He was an absolute sicko. I'm not going to get into it, but he was a dud as an emperor. He was not deified. Nonetheless, during his life, there were some inscriptions that called him a son of God, a new Augustus, the son of Zeus, the liberator. Well, not really. He was never deified after his death. And then there was Caligula. You probably heard of the famous Caligula and his excesses. He was a real nutcase. He was murdered. He was a huge disappointment. But here's an inscription that was found about him. The people of Halicarna erect an altar in honor of Gaius Caligula, a new god, son of Augustus, a new Mars. Okay, a new god of war. Wow. Then there were a couple more. Claudius, he was deified. And then it was taken away. They took it back. Oh, you're not a god anymore. And then they gave it back to him. He was reinstated as a god after death. Nero. We come to Nero now, who reigned from 54 to 68 AD. And he absolutely went mad. As you know, he blamed the Catholic Church. He blamed the Christians for a fire in Rome that destroyed much of the city. And most scholars think that Nero himself set that fire. And he turned around, blamed it on the church, set them on fire, set Catholic Christians on fire, used them as human street lamps for his garden parties, and unleashed this huge persecution against the church. And that's the time when St. Peter and St. Paul were martyred in Rome under this Neronian persecution. And by the way, in the book of Revelation, we talked about this in our Revelation series on the Faith Explained program. The letters of his name, Nero Caesar, add up to 666, the number of the beast. It's called gematria, where every letter equals a number. So, for example, A equals 1, B equals 2 in our alphabet. So the letters in Nero's name add up to 666. So that's where that comes from, by the way. So don't look for it in a barcode somewhere. That's the original meaning of it. So he was a dud. He was an absolute dud. He wasn't deified, obviously, after his death by the Romans. And then right after Nero, there were three emperors in about an 18-month period that were an absolute disaster. Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. 18 months for all three of them together. And the Roman Empire was in really, really rough shape at this time. After Nero and after these three losers, everyone thought it is all going to fall apart. And many people think that this is the time when the Gospel of Mark actually came out. I'm not 100% sure about that. But if that's true, then this would offer a lot of hope for the people reading this. Hey, don't look to these emperors, they're deified post-mortem as living gods, but you all know that they're not. You all know that they're a disaster. You can't pin your hopes on them. You can't pin your hopes on this guy. And so when you read Mark 1:1, the beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, wow. As one scholar, even the skeptical ex-Catholic priest John Dominic Crossan, who doesn't think that Jesus was resurrected, doesn't even think he was buried. He thought his body was eaten by wild dogs. He was thrown down from the cross, put in a shallow grave, and wild animals consumed his body. Now, that is a crazy theory. There's no way in heck that is true. And I'm going to explain a little bit more about that as we get closer to Easter. But even he says, hey, Mark 1:1, this Jesus, the good news, the Son of God, it's basically like saying, in your face, Caesar, in your face. I mean, this is a risky, risky thing to say. So Mark basically has the audacity to say that a Nazarene crucified by a Roman official, Pontius Pilate, is the real Son of God. It's Jesus on the cross who's basically saluted by a Roman soldier. He leaves an empty tomb behind, is risen on the third day. Well, there's an omen for you. If you want an omen, the Romans are really into omens. Man, they've been pinning their hopes on the wrong person, the wrong sons of God, emperors who keep falling and failing. So why not pin your hopes on the good news, the real Son of God, Jesus Christ? And that's what we have to do as well. That's what we have to do as well. By the way, good news, that meant something very specific in the Roman Empire. Whenever an emperor won a great military battle, or whenever there was a new emperor on the throne, it would be published throughout the Roman Empire as the good news. Have you heard the good news? We've defeated the barbarian hordes, you know, with Russell Crowe leading the army. I don't know. Or when Vespasian becomes emperor, wow, Caesar Vespasian has taken the throne. And they would put a laurel wreath, a crown on his head, and a purple robe, and the crowds would shout, the troops. It'd be like a scene in a movie. And that's why the mock deification of Jesus during the Passion is so tragic and so poignant, as they dress him up like a mock coronation of the emperor. And that's why they put the crown of thorns on his head and mock him and beat him and say, hail, you know, this hail King of the Jews. You know, it's a mock coronation of the Roman emperor. And so little did they know that here is the true King of the universe before them. And so As we look at what today is with the Ides of March, the assassination of Julius Caesar really led up to the situation that the church found herself in and plays into the crucifixion of Christ, that he is the real Son of God. But also, of course, for the early Christians, they were constantly tempted by the society around them and very often tortured to say Jesus, you know, they tried to force them to say Caesar is Lord. They would never do it. They would never do it. Neither the Jews nor Christians would do it. We think of Polycarp, who was burned at the stake. When he was being led into the arena, they tried to plead with this guy. He was 86 years old. Won't you just renounce him? Won't you renounce Jesus? And can't you just say just one time, Caesar's Lord? He's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And as he's led to his execution, they used to call the early church, the early Christians, atheists, which is interesting. The early Christians were called atheists because they wouldn't worship the Roman pantheon of gods and the Caesars. And so Polycarp was given one last chance as he was about to be burned at the stake. Tell the crowd, down with the atheists. And he said, okay, I'll do that. And so he pointed at all of them. Said, yes, down with the atheists. You guys are the real atheists because you don't believe in the true and living God and his divine son, Jesus Christ. And so lots of stirring stories like that from the early church. But it all of that began to unfold with what happened today in 44 BC, the Ides of March. So a little history for you there, a little background on the gospel. But to me, it makes it come alive because these things really happen in human history. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Be right back. 1-888-914-9149 if you have a take on that. And I want to ask your opinion about a situation I'm dealing with that just kind of came up, and I want to hear what you have to say. And I'll share that with you after the break. 888-914-9149. Today, we'd like to thank Richard, who's listening in Arizona, for donating his Toyota. Join in with thousands of other listeners to donate your old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the program, 888-914-9149. Hey, let me, as I said before the break, I wanted to share with you something I'm dealing with right now. Maybe get your advice on this so you can call in. I don't know if you guys remember, a couple days ago, a young gal named Maggie called in. She was about 14 years old, and she was asking about, you know, what do you do when your pet is really ill? And is it okay to euthanize your pet? Now, obviously, euthanizing humans, it's not morally licit, but what about pets? So we kind of talked about that, and I kind of mentioned to her, I don't know if you'll recall, that one of my dogs, I've got two dogs now, our original dog, Egbert, who's kind of the show mascot, I mentioned that he really wasn't doing well. And one of the things that happened just before we went to air, I almost thought I was going to have to, I didn't think I was going to be able to do a show because my wife, Trish, had taken Egbert to the vet. And as we feared, it was really, really bad news. He's really taken a nosedive over the last week or so, and he's having a lot of trouble moving around, and he lost a lot of weight, not eating, just not in great shape. And so, sure enough, we got the news that, there's nothing they can do for him. And so this is kind of the end. So we have to kind of make arrangements. And, you know, Trish was in tears, and I was like, I can maybe we can do a replay. I don't know if we could do the show. She's like, no, do the show. And I was trying to comfort her. Anyways, all that happened right before. And so now we're kind of asking the question, you know, how do we break this to our daughter, to Michaela, who's 6 years old, and this is her puppy. She's known Egbert ever since she was a baby, right? So we have a new dog now as well, who's about 5 months old. Her name is Poppy. She's a black lab, beautiful dog. But so I kind of eased the pain a little bit, but I just thought maybe some of you guys might have some thoughts. How did you deal with this? Because we're sort of asking the question, do we want Michaela to be there when Egbert passes? You know, how did you handle that? Is it too traumatic for kids? I mean, I'm kind of worried about how it might affect her. I don't know. Is she too young? Just wonder about your thoughts on that. 888-914-9149. I had this priest friend a few years ago. This is before we got a dog. I didn't have any, you know, pets growing up. I had a couple of fishes that they passed on too. Didn't exactly take great care of them. Actually, when my wife and I got married, we had a goldfish named Kent Clark. Yeah, a real creative name there. But anyway, so we had this friend. I'll call him Father George. And there's another couple in our in our parish who were childless, and they had these dogs, and their dogs were kind of like their kids. You know, you might know some folks in that boat. And at one point, one of their dogs got sick, and they asked the priest, "Hey, can you pray for our dog?" And the priest said, "I wouldn't waste a prayer on a dog." Now, I thought that was pretty harsh, but, you know, not. I kind of understand where he's coming from theologically, but I thought, you know, pastorally, that might not have been the most sensitive thing to say. But at any rate, yeah, just kind of wondering if you guys have any tips for me on how to deal with that. If you've gone through that with your kids, let me know. Let me know. I'd love to hear about it. 888-914-9149. By the way, something happened yesterday on the Patrick Madrid show, and Patrick and his producer, Cyrus Simcoe, were kind enough to let me know about it. Somebody was asking Patrick about something that I said on my show, and it was Tom calling from Tennessee. Have a listen to this conversation.
Hey, listen, I really appreciate your show, and appreciate Cale Clark, man. I really like that guy, man.
He's a great guy, isn't he?
You know, he had an article, and I don't want to, I'm not going to talk, but anyway, about writing, about books, writing in books, writing in your Bible, and I'd really like to get the name of that book that he was going over about writing in books, you know, writing your thoughts down, writing where you disagree, where you agree. It was just really good, and so...
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. Maybe Cyrus can pass this question along to Cale. His show is on every afternoon. He's got two shows. He's the hardest working guy in Catholic radio. So he's got the Faith Explained show that takes place, I believe, right after the Mass. And then he's got the Cale Clark show in the afternoon. So we'll pass this along to him, and maybe he can talk about it this afternoon.
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick. And by the way, the check's in the mail. Patrick's like, oh, he's a great guy. He's the hardest working guy. Thanks a lot, Patrick. It's very kind of you. And that's not true. But and Tom, thank you for calling in. And I hope you're listening right now, Tom, from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And what you were looking for there, that was a show that we had done a few weeks ago, based on an article by a guy named Joel Miller. Now, Joel's an interesting guy. He's a writer. He's written a biography of Paul Revere. Interesting. And he also has a really good Substack newsletter called Miller's Book Review. So people should go and sign up for that. So if you just Google that, Miller's Book Review, one word, millersbookreview.substack.com, you'll find it. And it's kind of an email newsletter that you can set up. And you'll get his book reviews sent to you. He reviews some really interesting stuff. And not too long ago, back in February, he had a piece called Five Reasons to Write in Your Books. Because a lot of people, they're kind of loathe to write in their books or write in their personal copy of the Bible. And we had a big discussion about that on the show. And maybe I'll get Jim Shaper, our producer, to put a link to that episode in the show notes if you want to listen to that whole thing. We had a spirited discussion about it. Yeah, so it wasn't a book that I was referencing, Tom. It was an article by Joel Miller and his Substack. And I'll just recap the five reasons he says it's a good idea to write in your books. Number one, it compensates for memory loss. hello, guilty as charged. Yeah, that's me. And so it's really good when you want to research, go over a book again. If you've written some little notes in the margin, okay, that's where that is. Retracing your intellectual journey. This is sometimes embarrassing because I've had the experience of looking at notes I've written in books years ago, and I thought, man, I can't believe I was such an idiot. I can't believe I thought that at the time. But again, it's cause for humility, and also it shows that hopefully you've kind of grown over time. The third reason he gave was conversing with the author. It's kind of like having a conversation. The book is the author's thoughts, and then you can write your own thoughts in the margins. And a lot of people did that, like the American founding father, John Adams, who was one of the early presidents. One of his biographers said that he wrote comments in fewer than 10% of his books. But when he did, he really made the most of it. Sometimes, especially in books about politics or political theory, he would add thousands of his own words to the original text. So imagine writing thousands of words as commentary to a book. It's really interesting stuff. Self-discovery, that's another reason. And the last reason is simply enjoying yourself. enjoying yourself. C.S. Lewis said, you know, why do people make scrapbooks and collect photographs of their times and, you know, make, if you're around today, you would have said Facebook pages about, you know, hey, here's your personal history. Okay, they'll do that. How come they don't make a hobby like that out of their reading? He said, some of the best times I've ever had is me with a book and a pen and just making notes. Did I enjoy this? A little comment on that here and there. And he says it kind of makes a book into a toy. It gives it the charm of a toy without losing the fact that it's a book. So anyways, that's a little summary of what we talked about that day. But thank you very much, Tom, for calling into Patrick's show today and for your kind words. Really appreciate you. And hopefully that helps. Hopefully you're listening and you got the answer to your question. And speaking of answers to questions, I'd asked you guys what you thought about my dilemma with Egbert and how to deal with that with my daughter, how to break it to her. Should she be there in the room? I'm kind of worried that, you know, if she sees my wife that upset, and I know she's going to be in tears. I probably will be too. And is that going to be a traumatizing memory? I don't know. So let's see what you guys have to say. Roger is calling from Sussex, Wisconsin. Hey, Roger.
Hi. Say, what is it that your dog is ailing from?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of stuff going on with him, but I know his liver has basically shut down. That's his internal organs are starting to shut down. He hasn't eaten in a long time. It's gone downhill so fast. Yeah. So.
The only reason I'm asking it is because of I have three dogs, mm-hmm. and my oldest one is he was diagnosed 3 years ago with engorged liver. And I said, well, what do we feed him? And the vet had exclaimed, if he were my dog, I'd give him anything because his time is very short. Mm. Well, that was 3 years ago. But there's a lot of faith that went into all this. I mean, I was out in the backyard with him quite a bit and touching the area that where his liver would be and said a lot of prayers. Lots and lots of prayers as I was touching the area where his liver is. Okay. I don't know if this is going to work for everybody or anybody, but I know that our time on earth is limited.
Yeah.
But sometimes we can extend it through prayer.
Yeah. And I hear a little, yappy one in the background there too. And thank you very much, Roger. And yeah, I've definitely been, we've been asking for the intercession of St. Francis, and I know we dealt with this the other day. Like, you know, dogs don't have eternal souls like people do, but they can really become an important part of the family, as you know, if you're a dog owner. And if you're not a dog lover, well, hey, you know, if you're a cat lover, I'll pray for you. I'm only kidding. Hey, come on, your cat doesn't even like you. It always runs under the bed when you come home, right? It's not that way with a dog. I tease. But whether it's cats, dogs, all pets, they're kind of signs of God's love for us in a certain way, and obviously part of creation that we're called to care for too. Going to go back to the phones now. Raina is calling from Lehighton, Pennsylvania. Hi, Raina.
Hi, Cale. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm so sorry to hear what you're going through with your puppy.
Oh, thanks.
I had, unfortunately, a similar thing happen to me. And it was almost like a year ago, and my doggy was really bad, and I was totally against putting her down. And I swore I was going to nurse her till she passed away. And I ended up myself getting really sick, and I had to have surgery and radiation and everything. So I realized that I wasn't going to be able to take care of her, so I had to put her down like a weekend before my surgery. And I hated it. It was awful. My daughter, was 18 years old, was with me.
Okay.
And it was hard. And she wanted to be there.
So she was 18. She was 18 years old.
She's 18. She wanted to be there. I didn't think she should be there. I had never done this before. This was my first pet I had to put down. So I think your daughter's too young because my 18-year-old was rough, and she wanted to be there. I think she learned a lot from it because when we got the news of my dog, her name was Lola, her diagnosis, she actually kind of wanted to put her down. And I was like, no, I'm going to nurse her. And she kept saying, like, well, she's in pain, blah, blah, blah. Hmm. And I'm like, I'll give her pain medicine. Like, I was like, yeah. I'm nursing Lola. And she kind of, like, had to learn, like, then she realized how what I was saying was going to be hard, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Raina, I want to thank you for that call. And I thank you for your opinion on that, that, you know, in Raina's opinion, that my daughter being 6 years old is maybe too young to see this. I wonder what you guys think about this. A lot of folks are calling in right now, 888-914-9149. We're going to go to Carol now in Chicago. Hi, Carol.
Hi. With our pets, we've always had pets. When my children were very young, probably even the age of your daughter.
Well, okay.
It's nice if they can diet right at home, and they can pet them and say goodbye to them, kiss them. And we would bury the dog in the yard or the cat, and we would make a cross with some twigs, strong twigs, and we would have a mass outside, say prayers.
Yeah.
And I really think that it's God's plan for us, because the children learn at a young age, and you can explain mm-hmm. to them that we will meet, he will be waiting for us in heaven.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for that call. And Carol mentioned that when her dog died, she buried the dog in the backyard. Now, by the way, where I live, that's actually illegal. If anybody saw me doing that, I'd probably be arrested. Basically what happens is in most cases, they will cremate the animal. And then if you want, you can get an urn with the ashes if you want. But and all this is, as you can imagine, it's pretty pricey. And they do give you the option that, your dog can actually pass away at home. They'll come to you. But again, there is a price tag affixed to that one as well. And so, I'm kind of wondering about this. You guys are helping me with your comments. I really do appreciate that. We got to take a quick break. If you are on the line, please stay there. I'll try to get to as many of you as I can. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. It's the Cale Clark Show. Really appreciate you guys all calling in about this, and I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the show. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. I've been asking you guys for your advice on how to break this to my daughter, Michaela, who's 6 years old. She's at her grandparents' house right now. Hopefully she's not listening to the show. She's going to get a sneak preview. I know what you're going to say, Dad. Our dog, Egbert, he's kind of on his last legs. He's really taken a nosedive health-wise in the past couple of weeks. I mean, he's 14. So in dog years, I don't know the math on dog years, how to figure that out. But I do know that's definitely up there. He'd be qualifying for a lot of seniors' benefits, as it were he human. But how do you deal with this? How do you break this to your child if you've gone through this? Do you think children should be there when a pet passes away at the vet? You know, obviously they put them to sleep. Do you think that's a good thing for them to see? Does that sort of help to prepare them for other more serious losses that they'll have to unfortunately experience in life later on? Is it part of the learning process, or is it something that maybe at this age I should maybe be sheltering her from? I'm going to go to the phones right now. Veronica is calling from Sacramento. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for picking the call.
You
it's
got it.
It's a tough one. But I remember a few years back, I was catechism class, and the question came up from one of the kids. I said, if my pet dies, is it going to heaven? And of course, I had to answer with the truth, and I said, no.
Oh, okay, we seem to have lost
it. Monday, I had a kid in tears. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. We lost you for a second there.
Okay.
I think what you were saying was that a kid in your catechism class had asked you, what happens to my dog after he dies? And you said, it sounds like you said, they won't be in heaven. Am I right?
Yes, I said they will not go to heaven. Only human beings go to heaven.
Okay.
And suddenly the poor kid was in tears, like waterworks.
Oh, yeah.
He was sobbing. I couldn't console him. So I went down to his level and I said, look, there's something very, very special about heaven. I said, God, you're going to be completely happy in heaven. When you go to heaven, you're going to be completely happy. So God knows that if you need your dog in heaven to be happy, guess what? I'm sure God will make it happen because you're going to be happy. So that really gave so much peace to this child, you know, just to know that in heaven, you're going to be happy. Mm-hmm. That's it. Heaven is a happy place and God can make anything happen for you to be happy.
Yeah, Veronica, thanks for that. I think that is a really good answer. And I heard even a theologian say that once. Somebody asked this guy, I'm not going to say who it was, hey, do you think there are pets in heaven? And his answer was, you know, if you need your pet to be there, it'll be there. So that's a great way to answer, really, because in heaven, we will be completely satisfied. We'll have God himself. Our Lady will be there, all the angels and saints. Please, God, all of our relatives and friends, pray that they make it. Pray I make it. I'll pray for you. You pray for me. But God will wipe every tear from our eyes, as it says in the book of Revelation. So there won't be any sense of loss. So if we do, now, I mean, in the new creation, the new heaven, the new earth, I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I'm excited. I mean, St. Paul says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, nor has it even entered into the mind of those who love God, what he has prepared for those who love him. So if it hasn't even entered into anybody's mind, it's going to blow us away, that's for sure. But it doesn't mean we can't know anything about it. And when God originally created this world, created the universe, he said it was very good. And so with these other creatures in the world at the beginning, of course, we have in Genesis the naming of the animals, all that sort of stuff. Maybe not your pet in particular may not be there, but the idea that there may be dogs per se in heaven, I'm on board with that. But yeah, I liked that answer too. What you said and what also this theologian said, hey, if you need your dog to be there to be happy in heaven, that dog will be there. So I think it's a good way to put it. And obviously you do have to be pastorally sensitive when you're talking about this stuff, especially with kids. We're going to go back to the phones right now. Sarah is calling from Wisconsin. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You got it.
Yeah. I we had to put our dog down right after we had our seventh child. And So I had children ranging in age from about like 12 to, you know, down to a newborn. And if it were my first child, at the age of six, I probably wouldn't have had my kids there. But my younger, like having a few more and they kind of, you know, all kind of see and experience what the older ones do. And I probably would do it now. That being said, okay. I did put the dog down when they were at school. So everybody said goodbye before they went to school. And then I went and took the dog to the vet and had him put down. Now, that being said, I also, like, I was just going to say, be careful not to, like, project emotions onto your kids. I feel like some of my kids were kind of, they were like, okay, well, you know, he's in a better place. He's not in pain anymore. Mm-hmm, good for him. I'm glad. I'm glad that, you know, he's not in pain anymore. I'm happy that, you know, we got to do this for him. And some of the other children were very sad. And so, you know, I just needed to let them emote the way they wanted to emote and not necessarily be, you know, because I feel like they really play off our emotions. And if we're devastated and losing our minds, then they're going to be like, oh, my gosh, is that how I'm supposed to feel when somebody dies?
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, Sarah. And I appreciate those comments. And it's you had a wide range there. And you've obviously been very blessed with seven children and different ages and how they process things. And that's true. Even, you know, when a loved one dies at the human level, very often, I've seen this at funerals, people getting angry at their relatives for not being sad enough, quote unquote, or not reacting in the way that they want them to react or the way that they themselves are reacting. And people process grief differently. And I think that's probably true of children as well. I'm not a no child psychologist or anything like that by any means, but like a lot of parents, I'm learning on the fly. And so I do appreciate all the advice that you guys are giving on this. I really do appreciate it. 888-914-9149 is Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Going to go now to Mark, who's calling from Newark, Delaware. Not Newark, New Jersey, but Newark, Delaware. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Cal. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We just went through this a week ago with our dog, Shadow. She was 12 and a half, and we have a granddaughter who's 6 years old.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Named Viviana. So same case. And what we did was we brought Viviana over about a week before we knew it was time for Shadow to be put to sleep. And we just sat quietly with Shadow and we pet her. And later when we were going out to the playground, not in front of the dog, I said to Viviana, now, Shadow's going to be going to doggy heaven and you won't be able to see her anymore, talk to her. And I said, she didn't say anything. And I said, someday you're going to go to heaven. And she said, not now. And I said, no, like 100 years from now. And we just laughed and that was it. That's how okay. we did it. And then we had Shadow put to sleep a few days ago. And, you know, the next time she comes over, Shadow won't be here, but that's how we handled it. So I don't think the child should be present when the dog is put to sleep.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you very much for that call. And that's one of the questions that I have, a serious question. And by the way, we're talking about the fact that my dog Egbert, who's kind of the mascot of the Cale Clark Show, is really not doing well. And we're going to have to put him down, essentially. And there doesn't seem to be any reasonable expectation that he can get better. Even if we were to spare no expense in trying to bring him back to health, it might not even be possible at this point. So should my daughter be in the room when this happens? How to deal with this? I want to hear your take on this question especially, and how to process this as a family. I'm going to go now to line three, Ken in Traverse City, Michigan. Ken, what's your take on this?
Hi, Cale. I have four dogs, and three of them I had to put down. One of them was 14 years old, mm-hmm. and yes, 14 is a old age for a dog. I would say for the 5-year-old, don't just tell her, don't have her present there.
Okay.
But just tell her that Egbert is going to the hospital, and it doesn't look like he's probably going to go to heaven. And when you come home, just say, yeah, Egbert's in heaven.
Okay.
And I have all my dogs in, you know, cremated, and I have them in wooden urns with their picture on it as remembrance.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ken. So your advice was it's not a good idea necessarily for the child to be there, maybe at the vets when Egbert is put to sleep. Okay. So that's a good take on that. So yeah, I'm trying to kind of process this, and I know my wife is too. Like I said, we just got the final word right before the show started, and you know, Trisha's a wreck, and we haven't really told Michaela yet. She's at her grandparents' place, but I definitely do appreciate all the calls coming in. How much time do I have there, Jim? Okay, all right. It looks like we're probably not going to have time for any more calls here, unfortunately. But if you're on the line right now and you didn't get through, I'd still love to hear your take on this. You can email me. You can email the show, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And I'm sorry that I didn't get everybody on, but I'm out of time. Wish I had another hour, but you can always call back tomorrow. I really appreciate each and every one of you and for caring about the family and for what we're going through. I know a lot of you guys have gone through it as well. So this is part of the listener family here at Relevant Radio. It's been the Cale Clark Show. Thank you so much. Jim Shaper produced. Patrick Alog took your call. We don't have the Michaela soundbite today. I was just been told, but that's okay. And Tim Reese coming up next, followed by the Rosary with Father Rocky. God bless. Talk to you tomorrow.